Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens, families, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Adolescent sleep patterns actually differ from those of adults or kids. Research tells us that adolescents actually need more sleep for good physical and mental health, as well as growth. 80% of students who get the recommended sleep are achieving A's and B's in school, while those who get less are more likely to get lower grades. Dr. Valerie Crabtree, Chief of Psychosocial Services at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, is calling on school districts across the country to follow the Centers for Disease Control and American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines on school start times. Dr. Crabtree states we do better about understanding the importance of sleep on our health if we start with the educational system. Dr. Crabtree joins me via phone, and I welcome her to 411 Teen. Dr. Crabtree, really glad to have you and appreciate you taking the time to share your expertise with 411 Teen.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm very glad to be here.
Let's start with sleep. That's what it's about today, right?
Yes.
So what is sleep? I mean, is one unconscious when they are asleep? Tell us about sleep.
So sleep is actually a really active state. And I think most people don't know that because when they look at a person who's sleeping, they look like they're just being very passive. But in fact, our brains and our bodies are very, very active while we're sleeping. And one of the things that's really important about sleep is it helps us clean our brain. So the toxins in our brains get flushed out during sleep, and this doesn't happen at any other time of the day, through something called the glymphatic system. And it really does take toxins from the brain, flushes it out, and replaces it with healthier, cleaner fluid around the brain. The other thing that happens while that cleaning is occurring is it really helps us take short-term memories and store them as long-term memories. And that's really why sleep is so important to learning and to brain function, is that our brains really need this time to reset each night. Mm-hmm. The other thing that happens is that we actually literally grow while we're sleeping. And this is true, obviously, for children and adolescents. But growth hormone is secreted during sleep. And when people are going through growth spurts, they in particular need to be getting adequate sleep. And in particular, the sleep at the beginning of the night, which is called slow wave sleep. And that's when the growing typically occurs. And so if adolescents are not sleeping enough, it can impact their ability to grow, it can impact their ability to learn, and it certainly impacts ability to think and reason and control our emotions. But I think most people know if they get a poor night of sleep, they might be kind of grumpy the next day or spacey and have trouble paying attention or be kind of irritable with people. And you know, if we think about that happening night after night after night, then we consider that chronic sleep deprivation. And that can then lead to longer term problems like depression.
What are the various stages of sleep and how do we distinguish them?
Most of the time, the only way to distinguish most of the stages of sleep would be to wear an EEG or have beads on our head while we're sleeping and look inside the brain. But we do cycle through lighter stages of sleep when we first fall asleep, and that's considered N1 sleep. We then go a little bit deeper, N2 sleep, and then move into slow wave sleep or N3. And that's when We tend to really store our memories and grow and do a lot of the important work that happens during sleep. And from there, most people will move into REM, or rapid eye movement sleep, and that's when dreaming occurs. That you usually can tell a person is in REM sleep, because if you look carefully, you can see their eyes moving quickly underneath their eyelids. What typically happens for most people is the beginning part of the night, most of the time sleeping is spent in slow-wave sleep, or that N3 sleep. Later in the night, we spend more time in REM and have more dreaming that occurs. So most of the time, people might recognize when they wake up in the morning, they were right in the middle of a dream. Mm-hmm. And that's because most of that REM sleep happens later in the night.
Well, how much sleep does one really need? And I know it varies according to age. So if you want to identify the various developmental stages and what is required, that would be appreciated.
Sure. So, you know, I think everyone knows that infants and toddlers need the most amount of sleep, and young infants may sleep up to 18 hours a day. Now, they're not going to do that all at one time because they sleep in cycles and they take naps all day long. Once kids get to school age, we tend to see kids give up their naps and all their sleep is happening at night, or should, at least by around the age of six. And so most kids in that age group need about 10 to 12 hours of sleep, and that should all happen at night. What's surprising, I think, to most people is that teenagers still need about 8 to 10 hours of sleep. And that's more sleep than adults need. And it's more sleep than the vast majority of teenagers are getting, particularly in the United States. And a big reason for that is actually two reasons in one, which is that
growth spurt. I was saying that growth spurt is occurring during that time also. Yeah.
Yes, that's exactly right. So the growth spurt is happening and they really need that sleep to be able to grow. And a lot of brain changes are happening during the teenage years as well. But at the same time, when kids enter puberty, we see this real shift in the timing of what we call the circadian rhythm. And the circadian rhythm, what that means is what our sleep-wake rhythms are. And in a younger child, they tend to fall asleep at 8 o'clock at night. Or if you put an 8-year-old in bed and they have relatively healthy sleep, they'll typically fall asleep by 8 or 8:30, and they may not wake up again until 7 o'clock the next morning. But even on the weekends, a younger child, even if they go to bed later, they'll still probably wake up at 7 in the morning because they have an earlier circadian rhythm. What happens when kids enter puberty is all of that shifts later, and that's something that happens regardless of using cell phones or tablets. It really is something biological that changes that rhythm. So if you take a 16-year-old and put them in bed at 8 p.m., they are not going to fall asleep.
Right.
And so because their brain just cannot do that. And one of the things that leads us to sleep is our brain secreting a hormone called melatonin. And so if we measure melatonin in kids, we can see in younger kids it gets secreted much earlier in the evening. Mm-hmm. And in teenagers, it's secreted much later. So their brain isn't even making that sleep-promoting melatonin until much later in the evening. So most teenagers can't even fall asleep until 10:30 or 11 p.m. And then they need to sleep much later in the morning to get those 8 to 10 hours of sleep. And 8 hours really is the bare minimum. It's like making a low C on an exam. that's barely passing. And most teenagers actually need more than that 8 hours of sleep. So if we think about a teenager who needs, for example, 9 hours of sleep, they fall asleep at 11 p.m., that means that teenager really should sleep until 8 o'clock in the morning.
And that's not what's happening when you talk to teens today. They mention, well, by the time I got home, I had to work. And then when I finished working, I went home, I grabbed something to eat, and I did homework. And by the time I got into bed, it was 1 o'clock, and I have an 8 o'clock class.
Yeah. And that, you know, and in fact, there are many schools that start even earlier than 8 a.m.
Oh, yes.
So, for example, in my, I have two teenage sons, and in their high school, they start at 7 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. And what that means is for the students that live the farthest away from the school, they have to be at the bus stop at 5:50. So many of those students are waking up at 5 o'clock or 5:15 in the morning. And, you know, if they're not going to sleep until 11, 11:30, they're getting about 6 hours of sleep, which is extreme sleep deprivation over the course of a school week.
Now, there are other variables that also influence sleep, if I am correct. And I think about diet. I think about exercise and the athlete and when that exercise occurs. And I've also identified that weight and gender seem to play a role in sleep. Would you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely. And socioeconomic factors as well.
Mm-hmm. So, culture.
You know, we certain, yes, and culture. All of this really plays a role in sleep. And you mentioned diet, and diet is really an interesting area to consider, because what happens is when we don't sleep enough as humans, we crave high calorie, high carbohydrate, high fat, and high sugar foods. And so that's, and part of that is because our brains are really deprived of the sleep that they need. So the brain is seeking out glucose. So it's really saying, I need sugar to function, because you're not giving me the rest and the cleaning that I need. And so for people who aren't sleeping enough, it isn't only that they eat more calories than people who sleep enough, but they eat the types of foods that are really unhealthy for digestion and for balancing insulin and glucose. And so with chronic sleep deprivation, people are far more likely to develop obesity and far more likely to develop diabetes.
Hold your thoughts for 1 second. We're going to take a brief break. You're tuned into 411 Teen, conversational forum for teens and other interested folks. This hour, I'm talking with Dr. Valerie Crabtree. She notes that schools across the country have delayed some school start times to alleviate problems with sleep. We're going to take a break. We'll get right back. Insufficient sleep in adolescence has serious emotional, behavioral, and cognitive consequences. Cognitive and psychomotor skills are closely related to sleep. Dr. Valerie Crabtree joins 411 Teen, and I had to interrupt you. You were talking about the impact of diet and how it affects sleep. I also would like to ask you to address, you know, this big craze in caffeine and energy drinks and how they... Yes, okay.
Yes. So caffeine is a real challenge as well. And again, sleep is really interesting because we can really get ourselves into some very negative cycles where sleep is concerned. So people who aren't getting enough sleep feel sleepy, obviously, and caffeine is something that will help them feel more alert. So when someone isn't getting enough sleep, they're more likely to increase their caffeine use, and they're more likely to drink caffeine all throughout the day and into the afternoon as a strategy to stay awake, and especially in teenagers, get their work done, do their homework, go to work, do their extracurricular activities. And then that caffeine will make it where it's very difficult to fall asleep that night, which makes them get not enough sleep, and the cycle starts over again the next day. There is caffeine in so many beverages beyond just colas. There, obviously, energy drinks have a number of reasons why they're not healthy for teens, including the impact on the heart, but certainly the very high levels of caffeine are unhealthy. I just noticed this past week there's a fast food restaurant that's now making slushes out of energy drinks.
Oh.
And then they have reduced price on that late in the afternoon, which is the worst time of day to be drinking caffeine. So with the teenagers that I treat, I really recommend no caffeine beyond the early afternoon, so really not past somewhere between 1 and 3 p.m. at the very latest.
Well, it seems like sleep issues and the lack of it is just a sign of the times. Would you agree? I mean, it seems like it's no matter what. Adults aren't getting enough sleep. Adults aren't doing what's necessary. Of course, we see adolescents aren't getting enough sleep. I guess babies are still getting the sleep that's required.
I think babies do. But, you know, I think you're right that it's a sign of the times. And we'll see even in elementary school age children that they're not necessarily getting as much sleep as they require to grow and function well. And I think a real problem in our society, in particular in the United States, is that I think we don't value sleep the way that we should. Mm-hmm. And people who sleep are considered lazy.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this, you know, you'll hear this phrase, I'll sleep when I'm dead, and things like that. And this idea that you're harder working if you don't sleep as much, which is really a shame, because I think of sleep as the third pillar of health, that when we're really trying to promote good overall health, physical and mental health, we think about adequate physical activity, healthy nutrition, and healthy sleep. And I think you need all three of those pillars to really function at your best. And as a society, we just devalue how important sleep is in the role of health.
Well, so often I've heard people say, well, I'll make up for it. I'll make up for it on the weekend. Can people make up for lost sleep?
So that is a tricky question. Certainly, if someone is sleep deprived, if they can sleep extra on the weekends, that's better than not doing that. However, there are a couple of problems with taking that approach. One is, even though it's better to sleep a little extra if you're lacking sleep, it is not nearly as healthy as getting adequate sleep on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
The other is, there is some evidence that getting extra sleep on the weekends could actually be more harmful than maintaining your same schedule. And what can happen, particularly, I see this a lot in teenagers, if they're waking up at 5:30 or 6 all throughout the school week and they're only getting 6 hours of sleep, then on the weekend they may stay up until 2 in the morning and sleep until noon. And that feels so much better because they got 10 full hours of sleep, which is closer to what they need. But now they've experienced what we call social jet lag, which is similar to flying across multiple time zones for the weekend and then trying to fly back home again across the country. And it's very difficult if you've done two nights of staying up until 2 and sleeping until noon to then Sunday night try to go to bed at 10:30. You're not going to fall asleep. And so it's like having jet lag every single Sunday night when you're trying to go back to school the next day.
Oh, that's not a good recipe.
No.
Not at all. what about insomnia? And I know that we all have problems with insomnia from time to time. I mean, that's normal. But what causes insomnia? And what about the various types of insomnia?
So we like to think about insomnia with something we call the 3P model. So there's three different words that start with P that create the recipe for insomnia. And one is something we call predisposing factors. So what that means is that some people are just more prone to insomnia than others. And it may be because they're just wired that way. They may have a high level of anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
It may be that their parent had insomnia and they have some genetic risk. So, you know, those things are just what the person walks into the world with. Then there's something we call precipitating factors. And so that may be a stressful thing that happens. It may be an illness. It may be a change in someone's life. So it could be something as simple as changing from middle school to high school and being worried about what that change is going to be like. It could be moving from one state to another or having parents get divorced. You know, there's a number of things that could precipitate or lead to the insomnia symptoms starting. And like you said, everybody has had experiences at one time or another where they had trouble sleeping, usually because of stress or illness or a big change. But what can happen is perpetuating factors, which is bad habits that can result from those insomnia symptoms. And then the insomnia can kind of take on a life of its own and become more chronic or something that happens night after night or very frequently. Mm-hmm. And so those are things that people actually have some control over, those perpetuating factors. So things like drinking caffeine all day long because you didn't sleep well the night before. That's an example of one. Another is people who may develop really bad habits about sleep. So doing things like watching YouTube videos on your tablet in your bed because you can't sleep. Well, now you're teaching your body that your bed is for watching videos and being awake instead of teaching your body that your bed is for sleep. And, you know, there's other things that people may do too, napping during the day, which then they're not as sleepy when it's time to go to bed, and that creates that negative cycle that caffeine can also create. So we really like to help people who are experiencing chronic insomnia think about what those perpetuating factors are so that they can make changes to those and hopefully undo that negative cycle that develops. Another thing that can happen when people develop insomnia is that they can really start to worry a lot about the insomnia itself. So they'll notice as it gets closer to time for bed, they're dreading going to bed. They're worried they won't fall asleep. They get in bed and they start watching the clock and counting down the hours and thinking what a bad day tomorrow is going to be. And so we can also help people change their thoughts about sleep so that they're not adding that to the mix of also, you know, the more worried you are, the harder it is to sleep. So if we can help people change those thoughts about sleep, they can usually sleep better too.
What about the use of medication? I know that tryptophan has been used with sleep disorders, and I guess it proves, because it is something that was in warm milk, when you heard the mother say, let me give you some warm milk, that will help you to, that will help you to sleep. But L-tryptophan is in other things. It's in chicken and turkey, and addressed tryptophan and other interventions for improving one's sleep.
Yeah, so you know, one of the challenges, especially with teens, is that there is no FDA-approved medication for sleep in children under the age of 18. There's no medicine on the market to put a kid to sleep or a teenager to sleep that's actually approved for that use. So that's something really to keep in mind. There are some medications for sleep that are used in adults. But even with those, they're meant to be used in the short term. And there have been some large studies that actually show that cognitive behavioral therapy and some of the things we were just talking about, changing thoughts, changing behaviors, actually works better than medicine to treat insomnia in adults. So that's even in the age group where the medicine is approved. So we really like people to focus on changing thoughts, changing behaviors, because those just have intervention has a lot more support in the research for being beneficial to changing insomnia.
I was just going to ask you about the impact of these over-the-counter type mm-hmm. medications.
Yeah.
Take a leave, you know, for you have an ache. I think about the student athlete who knows, yeah, mm-hmm. my knee is giving me pain. Let me take a couple of leave. It'll help me sleep and it'll help the pain.
Mm-hmm. I think anytime someone is having pain, they need to follow their healthcare provider's uh-huh. recommendations. So if their healthcare provider is telling them to take an anti-inflammatory to help with the pain and that should also help with sleep, then that is a recommendation that they should follow. But I think it can be dangerous to just make your own decisions about what substances you should be taking, especially if they affect a developing brain. And all of the, uh-huh. you know, all teen brains are still developing, so you know, we just need to be careful about that and make sure that someone is consulting with their healthcare provider about the pain that they're experiencing. And I think, you know, you brought up tryptophan. Melatonin is another very commonly used substance. Both of those have just not been well studied in kids mm-hmm. and teenagers, especially tryptophan. There's just not a lot of evidence out there that taking it as a supplement is really going to have a positive impact on sleep without having some other kind of effect. Melatonin has been studied more in younger children and more frequently actually in children with autism spectrum disorders.
Mm-hmm.
And there is some evidence that melatonin can be helpful for falling asleep. But it hasn't been studied very much in teens. It hasn't been studied very much in healthy kids. And one of the challenges with melatonin is that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, it's the hormone that's secreted by the brain related to what time of day it is that mm-hmm. helps us fall asleep. So if you're taking melatonin at a time when your brain isn't ready to release melatonin anyway,
right.
it may not be all that effective.
Mm-hmm.
And the other challenge with any of these supplements is that none of them are regulated by the FDA. So because of that, what you get off the shelf may not, what's in the bottle may not be exactly what's on the label.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is there may be higher or lower amounts of melatonin in that pill than what the label says. And it may have other substances in it that are not on the label. And so we have to be kind of careful around some of those issues as well anytime we're using something that isn't regulated by the FDA.
Well, lately, it seems like sleep apnea is receiving a lot of attention. Just what does sleep apnea involve?
So sleep apnea and the most common type of sleep apnea is obstructive sleep apnea.
Mm-hmm.
You also sometimes will hear people talk about central sleep apnea,
right.
but that's far less common. So when we're talking about obstructive sleep apnea, what that means is that there is an obstruction in the airway when a person is sleeping. And what happens naturally when we're awake, our airway stays open, we hope, and we can breathe well and we're upright and we may not have any trouble breathing in and out. But for all of us, when we lie down and especially when we go to sleep, the airway gets smaller because it's relaxed and we don't have the same muscle tone to keep the airway mm-hmm. rigid and open that we have during the day when we're upright. So everyone experiences that the airway gets a little more relaxed and a little more compressed when we sleep. When people have obstructive sleep apnea, the airway can get very narrow or shut completely, and that is what leads to the sound of snoring that you hear. It's the very classic symptom of obstructive sleep apnea is loud and frequent snoring.
Mm.
But what can also happen beyond the snoring is breathing pauses, and that's what the word apnea means,
mm-hmm.
is stopping breathing. So at that point, the airway can shut completely, and you can see in a person, sometimes if you're watching them, their stomach or their chest may still be rising because their body is trying to breathe, but the air isn't moving through the airway. And so that then they stopped breathing, and that can last for a couple of seconds. It can last for 15 seconds. And, you know, eventually what happens is that causes their brain to have a brief arousal because the brain is waking the person up and saying, you need to breathe.
Right.
So they, when you see a person with obstructive sleep apnea sleeping and having an apnea like that, you may hear them snort or take a really big breath. Mm-hmm. And so what it sounds like when someone is sleeping is you hear snore, 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 quiet, and then a big snore, and then they snore again. And so that is the brain waking up briefly over and over and over again all night long, telling this person, wake up and breathe, wake up and breathe. And so we see that obstructive sleep apnea is far more common in people who have obesity. And the reason for that is when there are fat deposits around the neck, that puts additional pressure on the airway. And so that makes it more likely that the person will have apneas during sleep. And then, again, because sleep is so cyclical, when a person has obstructive sleep apnea, they're more likely to develop obesity or to have the obesity they already were experiencing get worse.
Often you hear that adenoids cause a problem with sleep apnea. And so
that is far more common in younger children. In children prior to puberty, it is more common for obstructive sleep apnea to be related to enlarged adenoids and or tonsils. But once we go beyond puberty, it is far more likely with obstructive sleep apnea that it is related to obesity. Mm-hmm. Now, there will still be times it could be enlarged tonsils and adenoid. And there are some people who are lean and have no obesity, but they just have what's called a collapsible airway, and they will have obstructive sleep apnea as well. So it's not only people with obesity who have it.
Hold your thoughts for a moment. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I'm talking with Dr. Valerie Crabtree, and we are discussing sleep, what we need, what we don't get, and the interventions. Dr. Crabtree, I had to interrupt you when you were talking about sleep apnea. Were there other comments that you wanted to add?
Oh, just that. Although sleep apnea is more common in people with obesity, there certainly are people who are not obese who also have sleep apnea. So anytime we have a person who is snoring a lot, snores loudly, snores frequently, someone hears them stop breathing during their sleep, they certainly need to be seen by a sleep physician and evaluated for sleep apnea because it really can have significant negative effects on health. It can raise blood pressure. It can lead to heart disease, to metabolic syndrome, to cognitive problems. We know in kids and teens that those with untreated sleep apnea are far more likely to have school failures, so they're more likely to actually fail a grade because the brain is waking up so much during the night that they just are not getting adequate rest, and the brain does not function well during the daytime.
What about narcolepsy? Would you discuss it? How is it treated, and what is it?
Yes, so narcolepsy is something that we call a central disorder of hypersomnolence. It's a long phrase, but somnolence is sleepiness. Hyper means a lot of sleepiness. And the reason it's called a central disorder is when we talk about any central disorder, what that means is something controlled by the brain. So narcolepsy is a neurological condition, so it's related to brain function, in which a person is very sleepy. They're sleepier than their peers, no matter if they get more sleep at night or not. They may need naps during the day. They may fall asleep when they don't mean to. They feel tired or sluggish. But the other thing that happens when someone has narcolepsy is they can have what's called REM intrusion. When, if you remember from earlier when we talked about REM sleep, that's that dream sleep that we have. That should only happen at night. But sometimes when people have narcolepsy, they may have REM intrusion even during the day, and they may feel like they're awake but have a dream come into their mind. And so sometimes they may see something that isn't there. They may space out for a minute. So when teens are driving, they may talk about, I sat at that red light and somebody had to beep at me, and I guess I just wasn't paying attention. Mm-hmm. But they may be having something that's called micro sleep, which is where the brain is needing to sleep so badly that it just pushes the person into sleep without them even recognizing it. They also can have something called cataplexy, which is when a person loses muscle tone, and it usually happens in response to a really strong emotion. So for people who have narcolepsy with cataplexy, that may be when they're laughing, it may be when they're scared or very upset. Sometimes it can be very subtle, so it may just be that their face droops a little bit or their tongue slips out of their mouth. It could be their arm slips off of a chair. Some people will fall all the way to the ground, but that doesn't happen very often. And then another pretty classic feature of narcolepsy, because of that REM intrusion I was talking about, is people with narcolepsy can have hallucinations either when they're falling asleep or when they're waking up in the morning. And that's, again, because of that REM sleep, that dream sleep that's coming out when it shouldn't be. So the way it's diagnosed is that a person needs to have a sleep study where they sleep in at the sleep center overnight, and then they have nap where they are told to take naps multiple times the next day. And what the sleep center is looking for is how frequently do they fall asleep during the day? How quickly do they fall asleep? Are they having REM sleep? Because people really should not be doing that during the daytime within a span of 15 or 20 minutes. And if someone does have narcolepsy, typically the primary treatment is with medication, and those are medicines that are meant to help a person stay alert. Many times we will also recommend an early afternoon nap. So for a teenager, we might write them a note at their school that they leave study hall, you know, that a study hall is given to them after lunch and they're allowed to go nap in the nurse's office. Some kids would prefer to just take their nap as soon as they get out of school and not miss a study hall or a class to do that. And people with narcolepsy really need to be educated about the importance of getting enough sleep at night, of taking their naps when they need to, of taking their medication, because it can be unsafe if they're driving. Once someone starts working, if they're working around heavy machinery or anything like that, they can have those micro sleeps when they don't even know it's coming. So we really have to help people figure out the right kind of schedule for them so they can get enough sleep at night, get those naps during the day, and take their medication.
Is there a particular theory that you ascribe to when it comes to the explanation of dreams? I mean, do they just represent neural activity in the neocortex, or what is going on from your perspective?
You know, that is really funny that you asked that, because just the other day, my own son was asking me about one of his dreams, and I was telling him, I'm a sleep expert, not a dream expert. So,
okay.
So I don't know. Interesting, and not something that I study, but also not something that's studied a whole lot.
Mm-mm, I know. That's why I asked.
Yeah. So, you know, one thing that I think is interesting about dreams is, it, especially that I think answers your question a little bit, someone has experienced a significant trauma, they are far more likely to have recurrent nightmares. And so, you know, that leads at least me to believe that there must be something to dream content beyond just random neural firing. You know, I really do think our brains are processing what happened to us in some way that leads to our dreams, but I you know, I just don't know enough to say what that is exactly.
Well, what about the impact on sleep with our emotions. If we are depressed, you know, the depressed person may have either extreme. They may not be able to sleep at all, or they may sleep all the time. Mm-hmm. So talk about the impact of our emotions and the stress and the changes that we may be going through. And teenagers, adolescents, are prone to have a lot of emotional changes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, you know, this is a theme, I think, from what I've been saying, that it's another mm-hmm. area that really is a cycle where it relates to sleep. So, you know, as you mentioned, if someone has depression, they may not sleep much or they may sleep all the time. And when someone's sleep is disrupted, they're more likely to feel depressed. Mm-hmm. And so you get into this negative cycle of the depression may lead to insomnia, and the insomnia makes the depression worse, which makes insomnia worse. Yeah. And it can be really a very difficult situation for teens. The same is true with anxiety. Certainly in people who have bipolar disorder, the lack of sleep can be an indication that they're about to have a manic episode. So if someone knows they have bipolar disorder or knows they have a family history of bipolar disorder, and all of a sudden they don't feel like they even need to sleep, they really need to seek help. Because that really very often is one of the first signs that a manic episode may be coming. And then, you know, we also know, and most of this literature comes more from adults than teens, but chronic sleep loss is a significant risk factor for suicide. And so if a teen is really not sleeping well, they really do need to talk with a family member, a coach, a teacher, someone, a trusted adult, because the longer that goes on, the more challenging that is for mood, in terms of the more likely they are to feel depressed, to feel anxious. But the piece that I think creates the risk for suicide is the other thing that happens in teens who aren't sleeping well is they become riskier. So that judgment part of the brain is really affected by mm-hmm. lack of sleep. So if someone is depressed and now they're taking more risks, then they really could potentially be at risk of harming themselves. Mm-hmm. And we want to do everything we can to prevent
that,
feeling that way, from acting on those impulses. And so it really is important to talk with adults about that.
Well, I think we've established that adolescent development is accompanied by profound changes in timing and the amount of sleep and wakefulness. And one of the issues that you have referred to has to do with school start times. Some schools have adjusted their initial morning start times. What are you finding? Because I know you are definitely promoting that schools make the necessary adjustment for adolescents.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, it's only been a few years that mm-hmm. ago that the Centers for Disease Control, the American Academy of Pediatrics, just about every healthcare organization in the country has made the recommendation that middle school and high school start no earlier than 8:30 a.m. And in the districts that have made the change, it is time and time again that you see huge positive impact on students in a way that is truly astounding, that over the course of a year, you'll see grades go up, standardized scores go up, attendance improve, mm-hmm. parties go down, mood gets better, substance abuse goes down, motor vehicle accidents
exactly.
go down.
Mm-hmm.
It is really amazing. And I think as a professional, there are so few policy changes that you can make that can have impact on so many different areas like that. You know, with one change that affects mood, physical health, academic performance, and substance use, it seems like such a no-brainer that schools should be moving in this direction. Now, at the same time, it's very challenging for especially a large school district to make a big change like this, and there's a lot that goes into it, including bus schedules and bus drivers and after school activities and sports. And, you know, there's a lot to consider But I think the evidence is so striking and so clear that the more we can advocate for following the CDC and AAP recommendations, the better.
Have you found that school systems are receptive to this change?
You know, it's interesting. I think it really varies by school system. Mm-hmm. I think in every system, there are some parents and some school board members and some teachers who like the way things are, who don't like change. There can sometimes be this mentality of, well, I did it, so you can too. Or, because we often devalue sleep in our society, this idea that, well, those are just a bunch of snowflakes. They need to get up in the morning like the rest of us, without recognizing adolescent biology. And that, you know, that's what we're talking about here is biology.
Right.
And then there's other parents and school board members and teachers and principals who recognize there's some real science behind this, mm-hmm. and we can see other districts who've made these changes and see the benefits to them, and we need to do what's right for our adolescents and recognize that their biology is very important to pay attention to. And, you know, there are some superintendents, there's some athletic directors, school board members in districts that have made the change who are very vocal about, I was nervous about this, I didn't believe in this, and we've done it, and I'm astounded by the positive benefit that we've seen. And so they've become big cheerleaders and recommending it to other school boards that they follow suit.
In these last 4 minutes, what would be your general prescription, and I know you've identified several through our conversation, but what would be the general prescription for a good sleep? And by that, I'm talking about creating an environment that is most conducive to sleep, eliminating light or eliminating noise or the telephone, television, computer. What would be your prescription for adolescents and developing a good sleep?
All of that.
Okay.
So the answer is yes. Really, I think a challenge now is that people have so many devices and mm-hmm. so many of them are in their rooms. And, you know, we talked about melatonin being secreted when it's time to go to sleep. And light is what helps us stay alert. So all the light coming from these devices can actually suppress melatonin or cause it to be delayed. And in our adolescents who we know already have a delayed circadian rhythm, it can actually make that worse. So, you know, I really strongly recommend that people get all of the devices out of the bedroom late in the evening. So phones should go in the kitchen on a charging station.
Okay.
You can buy $5 alarm clocks. You don't need a phone as an alarm. And tablets, laptops. All of those devices should be off when it's time to go to bed. The TV should be off, and bedrooms should be cool and dark. It's okay to have a light snack before bed, but you don't want to be having something really heavy. Exercise every day is very important, but you don't want to do it right before bed.
Good. I'm glad to hear you say that.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. Exercise, you know, again, it's this third pillar of health. So we need to have healthy nutrition, adequate physical activity, and healthy sleep. But, you know, exercise too late in the evening will make it much harder for people to go to sleep. So, you know, you want to create an environment that's conducive to sleep, and it's important to have some time to wind down. So between the last bit of homework or the last bit of Snapchatting and getting into bed, there should be some period where your brain gets a break from looking at screens and being really activated. So whether that's reading a book or talking with your family or praying or meditating, something to separate your busy day from your body and brain being ready to go to sleep.
In the last minute, is there any current research, investigations that are going on that we need to be aware of as far as adolescent sleep?
I think there's still a lot we need to learn from the ways in which sleep loss affects adolescents in the long term.
Mm-hmm.
So we know what happens to them in the short term, but we don't know as much about these adolescents now that are exposed to so much light and device and so much delay in their circadian rhythm and what's going to happen to them 10 years from now, because we just haven't had them long enough to know. So that's something we're looking at more. Use of melatonin, I think, is still being investigated. And I'm happy to see that more school districts are making the change to healthy school start times and really measuring the impact on adolescents. And I think one area we need to look more carefully at is the impact on risk for suicide as well. I think that's really important for us to see what we can change to protect our adolescents from having thoughts of harming themselves or actually harming themselves.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your expertise on sleep, Dr. Valerie Crabtree, Chief of Psychosocial Services at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. That's it for this edition of 411 Teen. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. The 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Ken Smith. If you would like to participate in 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. 411 Team archives are available as streaming audio and as downloads from WFSU.org. Check us out on Facebook.